So I tried to find a creative opening by reading phdcomics.com.
But
And I realized that it's all true. It's funny because it's true.
everything is true in that comic. It's all based on real facts. Everything there could just be prefaced with the usual disclaimer of based on true story.
How many PhD comics printouts did you have on your fridge?
None, actually. But I had quite a lot of XKCD on my door, my office door.
Humble brag, I have a signed first edition of the first XKCD book.
Nice. Did you actually meet Randall Munroe?
No.
See, that would have been
I
good.
bought it from him.
That's cool, though.
Like an animal, yeah. Why did we need comics to remind us about the reality of what we were finding us in? Can you say that in English?
Of where we found ourselves.
Yeah, because in Norwegian you can say somewhat like
Oh, befinner
in the
seg.
reality in which you find yourself in.
You've got one too many ins there in English. So I would say the reality I find myself in.
Right.
Or if you were one of our previous vice chancellors, you could have said, in this ever-changing world in which we're living in. Which also has too many ins, but also made everybody who was at that graduation ceremony want to sing Live and Let Die.
Welcome to the
Hi.
Ontology podcast, where we talk about reality, the truth, and everything in between.
So I can't decide whether today's episode is about reality, about the escape to reality, about the escape from unreality, or whether academia is in itself a justifiable kind of self-contained reality.
Or just a
Discuss.
landslide. Right. It might get serious.
It might get serious. Let's see. Today's episode is like how we came to be former academics, which sounds a bit recursive, but. So, last we talked about it, everything in academia was like, it was lovely. Everyone was happy. Everyone was enjoying themselves, rolling around in intellectual, if I say intellectual stimulation, that sounds wrong. Having a nice time, nerding out. So what went wrong?
I think as with the paper, we cannot just jump straight to the conclusion. We need some data.
Right, that's fine. That was a, like a tease. That was a kind of the opening, you know.
The
Meanwhile,
abstract, yeah.
right, several years earlier.
So being an undergraduate, that was fine. Being a graduate, that is taking the master's, that was fine as well. Perhaps a bit more stressful, but achievement was made. And then going into the PhD program. Or do you call that graduate school? I'm not sure the nomenclature at.
In the States, it would be grad school.
Okay.
In the UK, it isn't really called that. I guess you would talk about becoming a postgrad, but that also applies to being a master's student. So, doing a PhD, I guess, is the phrase.
In Norway, we because most of the PhD programs are sponsored by the university, that is the state, right?
Right.
It's like a job, it's a position. But you're called a stipendiat, which in English would align to fellow.
Right. Fellow's a very posh academic position in British academia. If you're a fellow, you've made it basically, like you just get paid to do research all the time and you're probably not, well, not necessarily.
It would be permanent. PhD fellow to be technically correct, but
right.
So this stuck the temporary to the fellow.
Right. This may be a recurring theme. You're a temporary sort of fellow.
Was it? How was it for you to get into the PhD program? Did you have to get funding, or how was that?
Yeah, it needed to be paid for by somebody. I needed to eat also. So my first year got paid. There was some money available from the university. I was in a bit of a weird situation, actually. So, like, never do this. I did my PhD between two different universities, which are in two different towns, because of the collection of supervisors who were kind of interested in working together, and I came along at the right time, and it all kind of fell into place. So the university where I was registered paid for my first year because they had some studentships available, and I interviewed and got one of those. And then the rest of it was paid for by... Yeah, by the BBSRC, I think. I think the MRC paid for my master's. So one of the funding councils, which like is tax money, basically, paid for the remainder of my studies, I think. Yeah, so I guess I had to interview for that as well, thinking about it, for that money. I guess, did you go to like a regular job interview almost for this? How did that work?
So the way it works, at least... at most humanities faculties in Norway, is that there are some openings, like some positions for the PhD fellowships and so on. And you have to apply with a project proposal.
Mm.
So you have to map out the project beforehand. And it's not there before. You might... perhaps ploy with your supervisors from the masters to sort of build out a project which might or might not relate to his or her research. But it's mostly a pretty standalone individual thing, actually.
Okay.
You are going to do this mostly by yourself.
Mm.
That has been the mode, at least up to now.
Right.
So
you have to have a pretty clear idea of what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
And you have to pitch it in such a way that it seems feasible, and that it at least has some overlapping or alignment with the general study areas and interests of the department and so on. Mm. And there are all these sort of qualifiers where we are given from not supported to highly supported sort of degree on this project proposal. So... I did that, and there were 68 appliers, I think.
Applicants.
Applicants.
That's a lot.
Which applied themselves. Yeah, and there were 6 positions.
Wow, that's pretty competitive. But
yeah.
You made it. Well done.
Yeah, I made it. And so I think 10 of us were... taken out to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And so at our department, it's there are 4 subjects, or I struggle to find an English equivalent to the Norwegian word fog.
There isn't a good, you can say subject. That's fine.
Subject areas, perhaps.
Yeah, because like assuming everything is religion or philosophy or something like that, then like what do you call the things under that, right?
This is a taxonomy on a higher level, because it's history, archaeology, the study of religion, and cultural studies.
And does the building or the department or whatever have a name? Or is it called that?
That was
is
pretty
it literally
much the name.
The list, okay.
Department of Archaeology, History, Culture, and the Study of Religion or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty broad.
But the previous department for the Study of Religion were with Russian Cultural Studies and Christianity, I think.
Wow, that's quite specific. Why did they just put Russian in there? Like, in the other modern languages presumably went somewhere else?
I don't know. The Academy.
Like, this stuff seems to happen all the time, right? Like, you know, let's someone new is put in charge, or let's rearrange all the departments into kind of new institutes or schools or faculties or whatever. And then, you know, like they, in the UK, they probably kind of, they do that for a couple of years. And then when they fucked everything up, they kind of retire and like get, you know, like an OBE or something, which is, you know, kind of like a national honor award kind of thing. And meanwhile, everyone has to change their stationery, change the signatures at the bottom of their emails, change everything about how they talk about where they work. It doesn't necessarily affect the day-to-day at all. It's just a lot of noise. Does that happen here as well?
Yeah, sure. But if you take a step back, perhaps it's not a bug, it's a feature.
What is the benefit of constantly rearranging? Or wait, I can guess, but tell me where are you going with this?
Because I don't think it's good for science if the people doing it, sort of social constructions, are too stationary. I think it's perhaps good to shift it around.
I like the kind of interdisciplinary idea that you would be bumping into different people in the corridors and having different conversations. That seems really useful. But I used to have those conversations outside the building quite a lot as well. So I don't know whether it makes much difference. It's probably good though. It's good to meet people who don't know exactly what you do all day.
Yeah. Back to the
rabbit hole, first of many.
Yes, so there are this interviews, and you have a panel consisting of a representative from all the subject areas, and the department head and the administrative head, and also one other person that does something.
Are they there to make sure that you're being treated like humanely or something?
No, does that exist in the academy?
It's a token.
Actually, I think it is.
Yeah, so, it would be. It probably would be in the UK.
Like an HR thing. Yeah,
exactly.
So, yeah. And it's almost like the classic movie scene where you enter a room and there it is, platform, and it's dark and you don't really see the people, and
wow,
they ask you questions,
they shine a light on you and in your face.
Yeah,
I think it's a really hard thing to do. Like, you're making it sound harder than I remember it being. To come from like a master's degree and go, right, now I'm going to propose an entire program of research at the doctoral level. I've never done this before. That seems like quite hard. I remember getting quite a lot of support from my supervisors before sort of the interview and when we were talking about the research we might do, because they had ideas, I had ideas I wanted to build out from my master's degree where they'd also supervised.
Yeah, but I got a lot of support from my supervisor, though. Mm. He helped me a lot. But you have to draw out this proposal, and you submit it, and you wait for ages, hearing nothing, and then you get a rank, right? So you're ranked first.
Mm.
So I was ranked at fourth. place, I think. And then you're called into the interview, and then the rank rearranges based on the interview. So based on my interview, I came in first.
Nice.
Winning. And at the moment, I worked as a truck driver at the warehouse.
In the supermarket, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, for this a supermarket sort of chain.
Mm.
So in a big distribution warehouse, picking out all the groceries and stuff that went out to the actual stores. And I think this was 9 months in, and in May, and I still hadn't heard anything about how the interview went, I think. So I didn't really know if I actually got a job or if I had been outranked, sort of, and fell down on seventh place or something.
Right.
And yeah, the summer was closing, and I did not yet know if I were to start a new job in August, and I sort of have to quit my job now because there's a 3 month sort of grace period. No,
notice period.
Yeah, notice period.
Even for that job, still 3 months.
Yeah, because it was a fast job.
Mm. It was a permanent.
Permanent position.
Yeah. Wow. That's a long notice period. Like, by UK standards, 3 months is a long time. Most jobs here seem to be three months notice.
Yeah, if you have worked for over a year, so perhaps it wasn't. But it was close to having to make a decision.
Hmm.
But at the time, now previous department had actually called me and said, probably shouldn't tell you this, but you are ranked first. We will send the thing to the faculty. And I cannot promise anything, but it's really, really plausible that you will get the job. So do your arrangements.
Right. So did you take a chance on that?
Yeah, I did.
And so was it any different than being a master's student when you started?
Yeah. I got my own office.
Ooh.
And and the sense of having made it, actually.
Nice.
Because it's all this build-up, and from the perspective of an undergraduate or even a master's, the PhD fellows, they are...
You're in.
They're in, yeah, or...
Right. Getting your own office as a PhD student is quite impressive. That's like space is at a premium in a lot of UK academic departments. You often have to share with several people as a PhD student.
Yeah, and there are, it's not, I think it is, because even at the Faculty for Humanities in Bergen, there are other fellows that has to share offices. And I also did at some points share my office with another one. But if you go to the Faculty for Medicine, for example, in Bergen, it's more an open office landscape thing.
Mm.
And also the PhD students doesn't apply with their own proposals. They are usually applying for a PhD position on a research project. So they got sort of the project handed to them.
Right. Like, it might be quite weird for people listening to this who've not worked in academia. I don't know, that, like, to think about that most of academia is about working in an office by yourself.
Mm.
That was a thing that struck me after was, like, I wondered about, you know, am I going to be able to work in an open office with lots of people all the time? Because most things about academia are basically metaphorically or literally about being in a sealed box.
It can be, and often it's a very lonely affair.
Yeah, I agree. How did you make it not lonely then? What did you do?
You assuming that I didn't make it not, that I did make it not lonely?
Well, or, you know, like, did loneliness have anything to do with why you're not there anymore?
No, not really. We had this group, so my supervisor had more sort of PhD students under under him. So we have had a group where we had almost weekly text workshop where we read each other texts and commented on them and so on.
Hmm.
And also when I shared office, I also had some sense of, what can you say, not loneliness.
Community?
Yeah, perhaps.
Hmm. And so some years passed.
Yeah, and well, I did the conferences. I did the lecturing, some supervision, peer reviews. What more?
Is it worth talking about any of this? Like, for people with no experience of academia who might be listening, I'm just wondering, like, if any of this makes sense. Like, when you go to a conference as an academic, you're almost invariably presenting your work, right? For critique.
For deaf ears.
Indifference or critique as it comes, yeah. Depending.
Yeah, you do. Allegedly, you are there to give critique as well.
Mm.
But most people are there for the after party.
Is that right?
And the drinking.
I never really saw much of that side of academic conferences.
I think the socialization and the stuff in between all the talks tended to be the most interesting things.
Right.
Also, it seemed for most people attending.
I've noticed that about industry, actually conferences generally, it's often the conversations you have in the hallways that are more, that you get more out of. I'm not sure that's academic specific.
There were interesting talks, just to say, but there were also many not interesting talks.
So many not interesting talks. Although you could say that about industry conferences as well. It's, again, not necessarily limited to academia. That sounds very harsh. I'm a really harsh critic of conferences, though.
But the most interesting conference I attended, I think, was a conference on cultural and biological evolution in Aarhus.
That's a very specific topic. I'm going to guess that the in Aarhus does not relate to the conference topic.
but actually where it was. Aarhus being somewhat of in the forefront of studying culture from more of a biological, or even, they even have a MRI machine there, studying culture in the brains.
Nice.
Yeah.
There was a lot of biological culture going on last time I was in Aarhus. Everything smelled of manure. It was horrible.
Cannot blame the university for that.
Okay, sure.
but yeah, and it was a pretty broad conference thing. But the silence when the arts, this is high arts, professor had the talk about, what was it? About art reminding us of being in the womb, and music actually just being mimicking the heartbeat from the womb. The silence in the room during and after that talk, I have never experienced anything like it. That was a, yeah.
It sounds kind of sophomoric, like it's that's the kind of conversation I would have imagined having, like, as an undergraduate, quite late at night. But this was like a serious thesis.
Yeah.
Okay. Academia.
Academia. But it's great that that is possible.
Yeah, like, you got to have that stuff to make room for the other stuff, right? Like, there's, I think, academic freedom to explore whatever is perhaps an undervalued quality of it. Like, for every article you get in the newspaper saying, oh, isn't it ridiculous that someone got paid money to find out how cornflakes go soggy, or something like that, there are, like, hundreds or thousands of things that are interesting, cutting edge, useful, and might one day develop into something extraordinary that is like a life-changing technology or way of thinking about things or whatever.
Yeah, and also what we tend to forget and in research dissemination and how we represent research is that, yeah, you have the research topic or the specific project, but it isn't really about that. It's about the process, right? It's about the tools and methods that you develop or have to employ doing whatever. So it isn't probably trivial to research the sogginess of cornflakes. I guess it could be very technical and difficult, and the kind of stuff you have to develop to be able to do that are pretty useful.
Right. And partly, like, if that was someone's PhD, they're learning about how to be a research scientist. They're learning, as you say, methods and techniques and maybe use of tools that they didn't know how to use before. Don't say breakfast spoon, but, you know, like that kind of thing. Yeah, I think it's poorly understood. I think it's poorly communicated. I wince every time I read the word boffin in the newspaper, because as a kind of convenient shorthand for some old white guy in a lab coat who is, like, intelligent but incapable of communicating exactly what the science is about. I'm like, we can do better.
And there are this confusion about science being dealing with the truth.
Say more.
But science isn't that. It isn't trying to tackle the uncertainty.
You've got to unpack this a little bit. I'm following you, but, like, say more.
Because as scientists or whatever, what we're dealing with is uncertainty and the unknown. The stuff we don't really know. And the stuff we think we know, but looking closer at it, don't really know, right?
You're into, what's his name? Known knowns, unknowns, known unknowns, unknown unknowns. Donald's not that guy, the other guy.
The other guy.
Yeah, the other Donald guy. The guy who used to be Donald before we started talking about this Donald. Former US advisor, something, something. Yeah, anyway. We turn over very small pieces of a jigsaw that is upside down, and you only really get to turn over one piece at a time.
Yeah, building on stuff we think we perhaps not are so uncertain about.
Right. There's a lot of modification of certain statements.
And also statistics, as we talked about last time, it is about having some kind of grip on uncertainty and pinning down the kind of uncertainty we have decided to live with, right?
Right.
0.05.
Right, for example.
That's, it isn't technically a certainty or uncertainty, but it's a kind of a number that we have just decided to be the number we have.
Right.
Where we can tolerate not being certain.
Right. it's like an acceptable level of uncertainty, and we're all kind of mostly agreed on that-ish. The problem comes, of course, when you say, okay, well, that's the line that your science has to cross. That's how we know a thing is decent or not. And then you get into, like, probability hacking, where people will manipulate data quite heavily or deliberately otherwise to try and make it over the line, if you like, or under the line, I guess, so that their work is publishable.
And this is the p-hacking or the probability hacking, as you mentioned, it is so interesting and discomforting for many reasons.
Because
you have this, of course, not of course, but you have this Greek American guy. He wrote this paper, Why Almost All Science Are Wrong, or something.
When was this?
A couple of years ago.
Okay.
Let me find the reference, the footnote. Why Science Is Wrong About Almost Everything, by Alex Tsakiris.
Hmm.
And he and his crew are doing meta studies, so going through all the methodologies and the results and so on, and doing some kind of statistic, I guess, analysis on this stuff. And they find that the way statistics are being used, I guess mostly in the STEM sciences or the medical sciences, are not up to grips. It doesn't scale.
Mm.
So yeah, and as always, the truth is probably somewhere in between, but I think in a couple of years we will have some kind of large shift, just throwing that out there.
Okay. I mean, like in psychology, there's this enormous crisis of failure to replicate earlier studies, which... it's partly based on the fact that, like, a lot of psychology studies have been carried out on, you know, like, 19-year-old psychology students, a lot of them with quite small sample size, a lot of them trying to get over that probability is less than 0.05 line, blah, blah, blah. A lot of them just kind of flawed experimental design. But it's really hard to, like... I always come back to Mark Twain, right? Like a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still getting its shoes on. And like once you have a story out there about how it doesn't even have to be based on a study, for God's sake, like, you know, we only use 10% of our brains. Oh my God, I've spent so much of my life refuting that statement.
Because you only use 9.6%.
Come at me, bro.
I think the aforementioned Kahneman actually wrote a pretty good letter about the replication crisis.
I think I read that. It was very magnanimous, actually. You know, it was very unegotistical, if it's the one I'm thinking of.
Mm. And also the p-value, which isn't the something to do with the toilet, but statistics.
Yeah.
It's also highly misunderstood.
Right. It's quite because a difficult concept to wrap your head around when you come to it first.
Yeah. It isn't a probability per se.
Yeah.
Not like, at least for your study.
For those who have not had the luxury / pleasure of dipping their toes into statistics, like the TLDR, I guess, on p-values is that... Oh, God, where to start? You have to, like, it's a slightly arbitrary line agreed on by, I think, most scientists and social scientists, and that if you find a result that is unlikely to have occurred by chance, then, you know, and it goes over this kind of this arbitrary line, then you can publish your research. That's, like, that's a very superficial treatment of it, but that's a gist, right? You can publish your result as being meaningful. You have found something of interest.
Significant.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid the word significant because it gets used a lot in non-statistical contexts, and I try not to mix them.
Yeah, but and that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
And I guess. So what I loved about my statistical training. So the subject were statistics and quantitative analysis for the humanities, because the professor went into the history of statistics and the history behind the different methods and tests and so on. So for example, and this is a good way to teach statistics, I guess, because take the t-test, perhaps the mostly used statistic test ever.
Almost certainly.
That was invented in a brewery.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is cool.
You didn't?
No. There is a test called Brewers. Or is there? So anyway, go on.
Okay, so the reason it's called student's t-test is because student is a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. Because it was invented in the breweries of Guinness, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that either. This just gets better. This would explain some things.
And by this guy called William Gossett.
Junior?
No,
I might think of someone else.
William Seeley Gossett.
Okay.
And so I think he invented this method to compare beer samples or something, or the quality of stout, actually, reading from Wikipedia. And he realized that this was a pretty useful little algorithm. So he wanted to publish that. But he wasn't allowed to. Guinness wanted to own this algorithm. So he did anyways under the pseudonym of Student.
Nice.
And this kind of stories gives color to the rather boring formulas that we tend to stick in our textbooks.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Oh, definitely. Like knowing how a thing happened and why it happened and when it happened and who to, and yeah. That was almost entirely lacking from all the statistics teaching I ever got, which was very dry. And which in psychology also has devolved to, this is how you run a statistical test. Click this button, followed by this menu, followed by this menu, followed by this menu. And it's very, very difficult, as I think we talked about last time. It's very difficult to draw a line for people between that and what's actually happening. Like, and what's the meaningfulness of the thing that you just did on a computer?
Yeah, and also it removes the... Because statistics is a subject. It is the subject area. It is its own thing, which is with its own history. And there has been people developing this stuff and they have made choices, right?
Right.
And the whole thing about the sort of academic competition between those who wanted to do the inductive statistics and those who wanted to do the deductive statistics and all that, is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of background in that, but I feel I should read. Stick a link in the show notes, I'll read it.
Okay. And just to sort of paddle back to where we went out on this big sea of rabbit holes.
title.
So I think who was a renowned statistician that has developed, for example, the idea behind the p-value? Fisher, of course.
Yeah.
So in his proposal, where he maps out the probability value stuff thing, I think he says that if it's very low, that's just a reason that makes this study worthy of replicating. It makes it interesting to follow up on. And that's a pretty different notion that compared to what most people get from it today.
Yeah, it's a very different experience.
So what you can hear is that there are still some. There's an academic core, right? Still fascination with the stuff, with the science and research and the methods and the history and yeah. So what happened 40 minutes in, and
Right.
we have
We're just talking
on
about
this
statistics.
sea of rabbit holes, we have paddled around the island, the dark island, where the bad stuff are.
Help, I'm drowning in like the metaphor trench or whatever. All right, so there were some PhDs, some research was done. I did research for 3 years and then managed to get a quote unquote real job. Because in the UK, when you're a PhD student, mostly it's not treated as a job. It depends who's paying for it. If it's paid for by an employer, like a, not the university, but like a private company or whatever, then you're probably being an employee, but most people are quote unquote students at that point. And if they have jobs, it's sort of part-time jobs. Hopefully not, because it's pretty hard to do a PhD and work a part-time job. Some of them might get paid teaching also. I did a little bit of teaching during my PhD, which was really fun in my final year of being a PhD student. That was super fun. So fun that I thought, I want to do this for a living. I want to teach people. It's awesome. I really liked helping people understand and learn about new things. So I thought, okay, I like research. Actually, I was a bit like tired of research by that point, but I was like, oh, I like teaching though, so maybe I'll apply for some lecturing jobs. Apply for a job. Went to interview. Explained how MRI works as part of the interview. Like part of the interview process was to go and sit in front of the entire department of academics and give a short talk about something to do with your research, but do it at an undergraduate friendly level. So I talked about MRI and its use in brain imaging. And I got a job. And it was a permanent job as a lecturer, which like is now gold dust. Very, very hard to get. At that time was less rare, I think, and less competitive. Not uncompetitive, but just easier to get. Particularly given that I hadn't it in my PhD thesis yet, like it was still kind of being written. But that was, in retrospect, that was unbelievably lucky because cut to like 8, 9 years later, I couldn't have got my old job back probably. It would have been very, very hard to get my job back because I had not, in the intervening time, published enough papers.
But what happened with the, why did it become harder to get these kind of jobs?
It's really hard to say. Like, a few things happened. So, over the last 20, 30 years in the UK anyway, higher education expanded a lot. We kind of talked about this briefly before. Lots more people came out of university with degrees, which is not necessarily a bad thing at all. Like, there's a conversation here about why people go to university. And a lot of the time, the answer is now because everyone does. If you can, you should. I don't disagree with that, but it's changed the environment quite a lot. But it also means there are more graduates coming out, which also means that more people go on to do master's degrees, which also means that more people do PhDs. And I think when I was a PhD student, it was something like the case that 8% of people, so like 1/12-ish of people who do PhDs, then actually manage to get an academic job afterwards, which means that you've got lots and lots of people doing PhDs who don't then get into academia. Either because they can't, because there aren't the jobs, which is quite common, I think. It's like it's perfectly fine for the sausage machine to keep churning out PhD students because the university wants the money. But then there are no jobs for all these overqualified people. So they go off and they do, I guess, other things. And I think maybe that problem has enhanced over the last few decades, is that there are just more people coming through the sausage machine. Universities are quite happy to keep taking money to turn out PhD graduates, but then there are not the jobs, the academic jobs, certainly. Does that sound familiar from Norway?
Yeah, somewhat. I wrote about this, actually. I published it yesterday.
Mm.
About how students of the humanities can get into the private sector.
I think we should run that article through Google Translate to English and make you sad.
Or perhaps I just should just write it in English.
I could do it. It would be a good exercise for me.
You could, but I won't let you.
It's fair. It's your intellectual property. It is your words. You can take the guy out of academia, but you can't like take away the kind of grasping fingers. That's my work. I want my name on it.
Do you have a thank you note on the Medium thing?
Yes. That's fine. I'll take my...
That doesn't qualify for co-authorship, though.
Right.
Yeah. It would have in some sciences.
Oh, right, yeah. If I was more senior than you, I would just get my name on it.
You're just opening the Word document would qualify you as a co-author.
I know, right? I know. We're kind of dancing around the edges here of yet another thing, which is like... that, oh my God, that like getting your name on papers is publish or perish is the whole thing in academia, right? And has become more so the whole thing. You must churn out a phenomenal number of papers with your name on them, because everyone needs papers with their name on. There's kind of a big bun fight to get your name on stuff. And if you work...
You have to tender your age index.
You have to, right. Yeah. Yeah, stuff that guy.
And you wrote in our notes, the sausage machine. And I wasn't sure if that's sort of a comment on the kind of white male fest that is the academy or something else.
No, but, it's a great talk that Sir Ken Robinson gave to the RSA, at the RSA. It's sketch noted on YouTube, so the link that I'll put in the show notes has a fun sketch note illustration to go along with this talk, where he's really talking about how we have industrialized the entire process of education to the point where it's sort of students, even in school, are kind of just meat to go through the grinder and come out in this kind of very... like McDonald's-ized sort of product where everything is kind of the same because the scale of operation, like what you want if you're McDonald's, you want every hamburger in every single McDonald's to be the same. You want quality standards and you want that kind of thing. And he's talking about maybe less the quality aspect, but he's talking about how the scale of industrial education means that this is a sausage machine, is that like, you know, meat goes through and comes out the other end and we ship out these graduates. Or students from school or whatever who have kind of had this very one-size-fits-all education. And it does a disservice to everybody involved. It's less personalised. It's less helpful to people who are, quote-unquote, non-standard or non-neurotypical or, you know. And it's based on this industrial model, that the idea that you can kind of put stuff in and turn a handle and get stuff out. And it's very far away from a quality educational experience. And that started becoming my experience over the last few years in academia, was that it was very difficult to deliver quality teaching at scale. You know, it's hard when you've got 300 students in a lecture theatre to make that a good experience. I worked really, really hard to try and do that, to do, you know, like experimenting with like flipped classroom stuff where people go away and they do the reading and the homework and they come in and do more active things. I worked very hard to manage their attention, you know, for a two-hour lecture. I did everything I could think of to try and make this like a more interesting, more engaging, more personal, more useful experience, rather than I will torture you to death with bullet points for 2 hours while I talk incessantly and you write down everything that is on the screen. There's a lovely quote from someone, I can't remember who it is now, about like PowerPoint is the best way of passing information from the screen to paper without like passing through the mind of the lecturer or the student. You know, like that's not education. That's going through the motions. I became progressively more frustrated, as you may be able to tell, with this situation.
It is interesting, though, because the way education, the education and lectures was done in the earliest stages of the university and the academy were actually a guy reading from a paper, having the students writing down all the stuff because textbooks wasn't a thing.
Right.
And so much of how education or lecturing being done has kind of stuck without that frame.
It's cargo cult education. This is how we've always done it.
And sometime the golden age of the 60s, there are stories that tell that the education were more freer, and we had more charismatic professors and so on, and then they just tightened the grip again, and PowerPoint came, and we are back to the start.
Yeah.
People transcribe stuff in a document.
Right. I'm sure in the early days of the Academy, though, there was also a lot of kind of discussion and like.
That was the very early days where people were togas and just sat on the public sort of discussion place.
That sounds a little bit like a student night out.
Yeah, the foundations of Western philosophy are made on the students.
At toga party.
Yeah. Reality, man.
Yeah, have you ever noticed
what
that,
do you think of it?
What is red, really?
Yeah. And there's this cave and the shadows. It's wild, man.
Yeah. We promise there is more to academia than this. Yeah. Like, you taught a lot as well, right?
Yeah, because you'll get a position for 4 years, actually. And one of those years are meant to be consisting of, I think, up to, or at least, I'm not sure, 60% of teaching and 40% of other stuff, like arranging conferences or doing committee work or whatever. And how it works in Norway, it's actually pretty great. You're given a lot of freedom within those parameters. That's a difficult one. And also, if you're lucky, as I were, you also get a lot of choice and stuff within the teaching part of it. So they ask you, what could you, within the sort of subject that we have and the needs we have, what would you like to do?
Right.
And also you can make your own subject, like on the, like a specialization subject.
Right.
For example. So that's pretty great. And the kind of stuff that you see in the UK hasn't really happened that much in Norway yet. So, and perhaps to somewhat of a fault, which means that you are given full freedom in your teaching. Nobody cares.
Is that about class size, though? Because I think it becomes more a kind of crowd management issue when you have enormous classes. But if you've got like an undergraduate course where you maybe have 20 students or something, then I imagine you can do pretty much what you like, because scheduling rooms and things becomes less of a kind of university-wide concern.
I had introductory classes with, perhaps this is a lie, but I think it was like 70 or 80 at most.
When you were an undergrad or when you were teaching?
No, when I was teaching undergrad. Mm. And nobody cared what I did in the classroom or the lecture hall. So, and that's good if you are going into it deciding to be a good lecturer. But also can be bad because you probably should have some kind of feedback from someone who has done this before on how you're doing.
Yeah. Was there any kind of formal mechanism to get feedback?
No.
We had one. Really. As a member of academic staff, we had, like, you had to go and observe someone at least once per semester, and they had to come and watch you, and some kind of discussion was supposed to then ensue.
There has been talks about doing that, and people that, and I think this is a fair thing. We have peer review on all our research, but why not on education?
Because nobody gives a shit, that's why.
Yeah, actually, yeah. But yeah, and the lecturing and the workshops and all the stuff were perhaps the most fun thing, the most fun stuff I did. And the lonely research stuff was interesting and fun as well, but more frustrating.
Why was it frustrating?
Partly because I ventured on a project, and this is not a brag, even though it sounds, but it was perhaps too much before its time, in the way that, so I did digital humanities and tried to do distant reading and stuff with Python and thousands of text documents and so on. And the software and libraries and the stuff I needed wasn't really there when I began. Mm. But throughout the years, it came more and more. I guess it, the last year, suddenly the words to vectors method from Google came and just, yeah. open a whole new world, but a bit too late. So, and also, there are or were none in my subject that did sort of the same thing. So I was pretty much lonely in terms of methodology, and not perhaps. Mature enough as a academic or researchers to fix, sort of, to have the right people around me to do actually make the thing. So if I was doing, were to do this once again, I would establish some other contacts and have another network, I think, around me.
It's very challenging to kind of like have to build the entire field thing. Like it's, yeah, just developing the tools for that could have been a PhD in itself, right? And then like you actually want the results out as well, and you want to talk about those too.
Yeah, and the project evolved more and more into a more of a methodological study, which asked more, can these kind of approaches and perspectives and methods be relevant in a study of religion sort of context?
Right.
And it felt like cop-out, actually, even though I, on a rational level, understand that it's probably not, but it wasn't what I set out to do at all.
Right. I was going to solve, like, a huge part of visual perception psychology. And actually what I did was kind of replicate one study in like varying degrees several times over, and then like cobble that together with something else, and then like rinse the whole lot through brain imaging. But you know, you end up like the micro degree trying to explain like the significance of one's, not statistical significance, but like trying to explain like the size of one's PhD to someone. And like what you end up doing is drawing this tiny pinhead circle and going, right, that's my PhD. And then you draw this enormous circle around it, which is like, and here's like visual perception psychology. And then here's psychology, the whole thing. And you're just like, and this is me, this tiny pinprick here is me. And all I've done is replicate, you know, like another paper and extend that work a little bit. And, you know, like give the whole lot a kind of neuroscience spin by looking at which parts of the brain are involved. And that's it. That's all I've done. Yeah. It's tiny, it's a speck.
You know how visual representation works great on podcasts?
Oh, yeah.
So the kind of the illustration you made with your hands now, you put yourself the little dot in the center.
Yeah, that was wrong. Actually, I don't do this when I draw it. I actually draw it like the little dot is right off to the side.
It's a little sort of dent or bump,
yeah,
or boob on the large breast that is science.
Title.
Yeah. So or nipple. That's a word. And you forgot to draw your ego, which is a huge circle surrounding all this.
Not by the end, it's
your
not
ego, but everyone's ego.
Yeah,
in the PhD,
but by the end, yeah, your ego is like, if you were to zoom in on the little nipple bit that is your thesis, like it's not even visible at that point.
Yeah, but you actually submitted and got the grade, Dr.
Yeah,
Atherton.
Eventually. Yeah, so like when you finished your research, you have to write it up in a thesis or as papers. Then you sit down in front of a bunch of hard asses. Well, in Norway, I think it's more serious. In the UK, it's like typically two, one from inside the university and one from outside. And they ask you a bunch of tough questions. They've read your work and they ask you a bunch of questions to ascertain whether it was actually you who wrote it and you understand it. And to kind of nitpick some of the stuff that's come up that they're not satisfied with, or that they don't understand, or that hasn't been explained well, or just to kind of like to get to the bottom of some stuff. And the outcome of that can be that they pass you right away and they say, all right, that's fine. You've satisfied the result, you know, you satisfied the requirement and we found a typo on page 72, or like, could you just add something here about blah, blah, because we feel that that would make it a better thesis or whatever. Or they go, this is good in principle, but it needs more work. You know, like resubmit the written version of this and we'll have a look at it and we'll check it. And if we're happy with that, you're good to go. And that was the kind that I got, where the writing up wasn't quite right enough. Like, it was basically done, but there was some stuff where they were like, you need to change some things here and here. And there was a sufficient number of you need to change or you need to add to or whatever that they were like, right, okay, submit again. You've got like a year to kind of tidy this up satisfy the criteria that we will list out for you. And that's like hugely frustrating. Like, it feels really personal. And it's not. It's in the process is there to give you a better thesis, like to produce a thing that can be read and understood by people later on, you know, which is the whole point of publishing science, is that people can read your work, digest it, think about it and build on it. But at the time, it just feels like, you fuckers. So it's really kind of like a horrible, horrible ego dent, you know, at the end of like a long slog, which was pretty damaging to the ego as well. So at that point, you're just this kind of fragile shell of a person, and you're glad that you made it out alive, but that's really it. So that it took me like another year. I was writing up the kind of corrections. I'm trying to think about this. When I got my academic job, I had a year to finish writing the original version, and then I submitted that, and then it took a long time to actually get to the point of sitting down with these people and having that interview, the viva, viva voce, and then... going around again with the corrections. So it actually took like a couple of years to get through this process. And I was doing a full-time job when I was writing my corrections as well. Like I had a little bit of time allowed for the fact that I hadn't submitted my thesis yet, but I was teaching and researching, not doing very much research that year actually, but like I was doing a full-time teaching job as well as trying to write up. So that was quite challenging. But it's also really good. There were also like a few weeks where I was just like, right, I'm just going to write thesis and listen to Radiohead. And that's all I did. It was great. Yeah. So I
did it feel like your iron lung? No, sorry.
Oh, later Radiohead. Electronic Radiohead.
I don't know for people outside of... Do you think anyone outside the Academy listens to this podcast? Yeah, perhaps.
Maybe a few people.
Yeah. I don't know. It might sound a bit extraordinary, but this kind of story, that's the regular mode of the Academy.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is how it goes.
And being a young person or aspiring researcher, having to tackle many sort of, not positions, but obligations, and just working a whole damn lot all the time.
There is.
Weekends.
Right.
Holidays, yeah.
Whatever. There is no traffic cop for the work that piles up in academia. There is no one to say, yeah, we think maybe you've got a bit too much on your plate, so what we're going to do is we're going to take you off this thing and put you on that other thing. It's just like, now you have to do this thing. Oh, now you have to do this as well. Right, yeah. Right.
Shouldn't you be writing?
Right.
yeah. And for me, at least, you know what? I think we have to do a fourth
episode. I know.
Episode.
We're so far away from being able to explain this.
But, yeah. So talking about the way the PhD submission, pun intended, works in Norway, you mentioned it's a bit more serious, and it is. Because when you submit your thesis, they usually try to find the expert sort of on the subject.
Right. That sort of happens in the UK. Like, you want to find someone who knows about this thing, but it's not necessarily going to be the person, because that person is probably, like, way busy.
Yeah, but they try to the person, or at least the person next to the person. and also another one who is more an expert on the kind of methodology or the mode of research that you did. And also a third one from within the department.
Right.
And they will read your stuff and come back with comments and either approve or disapprove the thesis based on the quality and so on. And if they approve, you will be able to defend it. And because most PhDs are funded by the state, this will be a public defense, actually.
Right. I've heard this. Anyone can come.
Yeah, so it has to be announced in the newspapers. They will sort of submit a press release for it. And people are welcome to come, even though they seldom do. It's mostly family and colleagues and so on.
Oh, that would be even worse, having your family there, than like total strangers, honestly.
It is pretty normal for your parents and siblings and so on to come to these kind of things.
Oh, God, that sounds unbearable. Like, I'm so glad of the kind of locked room and like, in a university that I was in. Oh, my God.
I think it's good, actually.
And, well, they can see what the point is of like the last several years, right?
But it's a two-parter, because the first day, you will give a trial lecture. So you're given a subject which tends to be a more... give an introductory lecture on this thing that relates to what you have written about or something. And that's meant to be sort of available, easy for non-academics to understand. Or that's the intent. It's not that often practiced, but that's another story. So you have this kind of trial lecture, And theoretically, you can fail that lecture. But I had never heard anyone actually done that, even though they have read from a paper and stuff.
Ouch.
Like so it most probably will get accepted, and the day afterwards you will have the defense of your thesis. So the first opponent are given, I think, up to 2 hours just churning through it, asking questions and so on. And then the second opponent have a bit less time to give his or her remarks.
Are they really called opponents?
Yeah.
Jesus. Like, why don't they just, like, fling animals at you, like, of increasing size and, like, claw sharpness until, you know, you kind of beat the table and say, right, I'm done now, and they decide whether you were, like, badass enough.
And it's all often a sort of a bad cop, good cop situation.
Right.
But they are given some instructions. Sort of
fling the smaller animals first.
usually it is. It can be a challenging affair, of course, but they also are mostly, most of them are generous. So they will also praise you and say, this stuff is great and interesting and so on.
You throw koala bears and kittens.
Yeah.
Okay.
And most probably you will pass the defense. Then it's usually you will give a party or a sort of a feast.
Mm.
Where you will invite the opponents and the department head and family and friends.
Like out to a restaurant, at your home, what?
Most do it out in a restaurant, or they actually will sort of lend a sort of a party space on a hotel or something. Yeah.
Wow, that's a big deal.
And the kicker is, or not the kicker, but if you have done this within these four years, sort of within the period where you have the fellowship, you will actually be paid back 20,000 kroner to cover the party from the state.
That's amazing. Wow. That's very generous. I mean, that's like 2,000... pounds, that's, you know.
Hmm.
Wow. Okay.
So Norway is the greatest place to do your PhD? No kidding. And next time, why Norway also is not a great place to do the PhD?
Right. Yeah, we don't seem to have quite got there yet.
I think this is a good setup for what comes next time.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. We talked about statistics a lot. Is that what people like to hear?
We will make them.
Yeah, I'm sure it will reward listening, right? Yeah, this seemed to be a very administrative, like academic, administrative heavy podcast, but like... The whole of the academy is kind of about, here's the system, here's your place in that system. You are worthless. Maybe if you work very, very hard, you will one day be worth something. Here, have these small tokens, or in your case, you know, 20,000 kroner worth of appreciation. But people do it because they are fascinated by the study area, right?
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a thing that people just do because that's what you do now. This is a thing that people are like, right, I'm going to give my life over for 3 or 4 years to learning about this thing.
Either that or they just like mental pain.
Yeah. Doing a PhD is an endurance sport. I was chatting to a guy the other day who was in the final throes of writing up a thesis. And I was just like, look, you've done all the hard work at this point. It's really just put one foot in front of the other. And everyone's like, oh, you must be so clever. You know, like doing a PhD, you must be so clever. And you're like, no, I'm determined. It helps if you're clever, but 90 to 95% of it is just hanging in there.
I'm not sure if it's help.
To be clever.
If it helps to be clever.
Sometimes I would say it's actively disadvantageous.
Yeah. Yeah, don't think.
Yeah, think just enough. I think being a career, no, as a PhD student, I think it's great to be clever. I think as a career academic, and this is really next week's topic, it is actively disadvantageous to be someone who actually thinks about things other than one's immediate research area.
So we both have friends still within the academy.
Yeah. Do you have survivor guilt?
What do you think they would... No, but what do you think they would... What's their take on what you just said?
What? Like, I've just insulted everyone I know and everyone you know. I think either they are quite happy enough doing nerding out on the thing and that's enough for them. Or...
Can I have this?
Yeah, that's fine. They're happy enough nerding out on that and their needs are basically met. Or they are dissatisfied, but they don't know what else they could possibly do and they don't know how to get out. And I guess we can talk a bit next time about how it's really hard to get out, and even if you want to get out of academia, it's quite easy to feel like you're just stuck. And underground railroads became a thing. But I guess that's like a teaser for next time.
I think we can do the words of the week next time, because they seem to be more related to what you are going to talk about.
Okay. And sorry, you asked me a question. I think I only gave you half an answer. I was slightly distracted by Ara coming in.
That's very academic of you.
Well, to actually answer the question. Yeah, I'd never make a politician. And the other half is, like, it's really satisfying. Lots of academia is really satisfying intellectually. And, you know, like, if you have any kind of academic community, it's also really engaging to be a part of that. And there's so much that it rewards. At the same time, if you are a person who is dissatisfied by slow feedback, dissatisfied by slow change, dissatisfied by people's lack of appetite for change, it doesn't suit.
I think we could just leave that as not a cliffhanger, but perhaps just a cliff.
Yeah, a cliff's note.
A Sisyphus cliff.
That's hard to say.
And next time.
Tune in next time to find out why we're not in academia anymore. I suspect we've dropped several big hints here, but it's pretty complicated.
And it can perhaps turn into the swearing episode.
I know, I wondered if that was going to happen, actually. I hope so, in a way. Or at least a big trailer. All right.
Ha det bra. Takk for at du hørte på.
Hvis det noen som fortsatt hører på denne, takk for at du hørte på. Ha det bra.